The Front Porch People is a fun and engaging podcast and radio network, presenting shows with great conversations full of wit, wisdom, and wonder. Their newest program, The Sound of Movies, celebrates the soundtracks of your favorite films and gives a vivid retelling of the plot through the music of each memorable score. Listen to The Sound of Movies and other creative podcasts from The Front Porch People on iTunes or go to thefrontporchpeople.com. That's thefrontporchpeople.com. Join the conversation.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And we are here doing Maltin on Movies today with, well, I don't know what to say. We're here with Jordan Peele. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
You're a big deal.
Thank you.
I mean, wow. You were a big deal before this past year. No question of that.
Well, I just said to my dad, in the last year and a half span, you got married.
Yes.
You had a little baby person.
Yes.
You're nominated for an Academy Award, and you've gotten all of these accolades from groups across the country and the world.
Yeah.
Jordan Peele, this is your life. It's kind of...
It feels like I'm living in a simulation.
Yeah.
One of those things that, you know, it's like you couldn't write this type of year. But I feel that in so many areas, on the good and bad, mm-hmm. this year. It feels like we've sort of jumped ship into some kind of weird alternate reality. And it's bizarre, but I'm very fortunate.
Sure. Well, a lot of people who don't live in Los Angeles, don't live or work in Los Angeles, may not fully understand the intensity of award season.
Right.
Or how long it goes.
Right. It's like 6 months.
Yeah.
Or the people with infants who already aren't sleeping.
Yes.
I don't really know how any of you function.
Okay. I'm glad you brought it up. It's hard.
I don't know how. Honest to God, I don't know how. And this is true. I always refer back to your Sally Field moment where when she was touring around for Lincoln, saw my dad and he said, "How are you?" And she said, "Exhausted." Because
the last time she'd been nominated was quite some years earlier.
Right.
The dog and pony show was not extreme.
It had grown exponentially in those intervening years. And she was just really taken aback.
Yeah, it doesn't It's a sort of disruptive process.
Yes. Yeah, no one wants to complain about it.
Yeah,
right.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, every once in a while you hit these points where, and you know, it's not for me. It's not so much like the time commitment or the fact that you're meeting people. It's this idea of the work that you could be doing. You're so inspired.
You don't get to be creative right now.
Right. All the energy that people are giving you back and saying for me to be doing this, you know, about a film that came out a year ago.
Right.
It makes you
lose your mind.
Almost crazy. Almost crazy. But you know, the realization that calms you down is how it's bigger than me,
mm-hmm.
and it's big. It's more the, you know, what these awards and specifically what the Academy Awards mean to young people and young artists,
mm-hmm.
to be able to know that you can sort of reach the pinnacle of regard in the industry with a risk or with a story that is maybe coming from outside.
Mm-hmm.
The norm.
Yeah.
It's very special to me. And so that's my calming factor. Is like, you know what? Don't get all caught up in your own business.
Yeah.
This is you're part of something very cool and part of something that's been around for many years.
Yeah. No, it's the history, the continuity, the tradition.
Yeah.
Did you grow up watching the Oscars?
Oh yeah.
So did I, and we both grew up on the East Coast. So for it meant staying up late on a school night.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
It was a big deal.
It was a big deal. I remember always getting this feeling watching the Oscars. This is burning. This this desire to be included. And it was, and there was a sorrow to it because I really believed I would never be included in this industry. And I felt like I had so many stories to tell, but you know, I just felt, you know, you see what the numbers are. It's so hard to be, to get to the point where someone will give you money to make a story, to make a movie.
Well, I'll be honest with you, something that my dad and I have been discussing a lot is we look at our guests on this podcast, and our guests, in some cases, they're friends of ours. In some cases, there are people who are doing the rounds. In some cases, they're just really, really cool creative folks we want to get to talk to. And I said to my dad last year, I said, I feel like we talk to a lot of white men. And the thing is, I say that, and I'm so grateful to everyone who gives us their time. Mm-hmm. And I would never look at any of this as, oh, I can't believe I had to talk to Richard Donner. My life is so hard, you know? It's not that. But I am very much aware that we've seen Greta Gerwig over the years. Mm-hmm. And I have said to her every single time, please, I want to talk to you because you're a woman. And mm-hmm. that's important. And not more important than someone else, mm-hmm. but like you say, I want people to see themselves.
Yeah.
And when I got to meet Angela Robinson, who did Professor Marston and the Wonder Women, mm-hmm. you know, there too, we got to have Dee Reese on the show, which was very mm-hmm. exciting for me. Mm-hmm. So my personal mission, as I speak to different people, is mm-hmm. I want a little bit of everyone.
Well, that's good. And obviously, like, you know, steps are being taken in the industry.
Yeah.
And I think the business behind outsider voices, quote unquote outsider voices, has been proven now.
Yeah.
So there's an undeniable momentum now, and it's just so exciting. It's an exciting time for film.
Mm. Now, Mario Van Peebles,
yes,
always quotes his father as saying, "Hollywood isn't black. Hollywood isn't white. Hollywood is green. It's all about money."
Yeah.
Mm.
And so you've done that. You've proven yourself somebody who can deliver a film that's not only really, really good and original and provocative and all that, but to even make them a couple of bucks.
Well, and, you know, it's there's this systemic problem that is a history of lack of inclusion. Mm-hmm. And then, but there's, you know, as you said, there's this business side of things as well. And basically what happens is in this industry, it's enough money that people don't want to take risks. Mm-hmm. People want to play it safe. So when you have an industry built on not taking risks, it's very hard to sort of turn the Titanic.
Yes.
Pun intended.
Yes.
It's very hard to get to the point where you're seeing diversity get its shot in the first place.
Yeah.
Because let's just play it safe. So for the business part of it to be proven and to kick in is just a huge, huge piece of it. And I think we're just going to see more and more.
Yeah.
Now to start with a what may be a painfully obvious dumb question, you'll call me on it if you choose. Were you a class clown?
No.
Whoa.
I was not the class clown, but I watched the class clown and observed. That's a Waiting for Guffman line. I can't go for Eugene Levy said that in Waiting for Guffman. I was much more introverted. Mm-hmm. I was not the guy that was in class, you know, yelling or dancing or, you know, whatever, putting the, dancing with the skeleton in class. I'm really the kind of guy that, in a one-on-one, I'm a cut up, mm-hmm. and you know, with like a couple of friends, I would be.
Are you Michigan J. Frog?
A little bit of Michigan J. Frog, but I think very interesting. When I was 10, 11, something switched, and I was able to get up on stage, and you know, I think I had a natural ability, which it was a very surprise to my my mother and everybody, because I was kind of a quiet kid and, you know, artistic, kind of introspective. Then all of a sudden I'm up there, you know, singing show tunes and doing the hello, my baby, you know, doing the whole thing. So, but it very revealing to me, because I almost thought I was a shy kid. And yet when I put into that situation, I could sort of deliver with a certain amount of comfort, and then it'd be over and I'd be petrified again.
Which is not
yeah.
Which is not uncommon.
You have a stage fright.
Extreme stage fright.
Well, okay.
Not speaking. Speaking is fine.
Okay.
Singing. I went to school for music.
Oh, my goodness.
I am terrified to sing in front of people.
Wow. Was that always the case throughout school? Oh, my
goodness. Since I was a kid. Yep. And my parents would always go, Jesse, why? I don't know. I don't like it. But I can get up and talk. Talk doesn't bother me. Make me sing and I'll turn into the shyest.
You got past that barrier of stage fright once you were on the stage.
Yeah, that's kind of how it would happen. And then, you know, I was hooked because it was working, but I don't think I really rid myself of any type of stage fright until recently. You know, maybe a few years ago. I almost needed to get into a place where I've failed enough that you sort of realize, you know what, you can have a huge, you know, fall on your face moment, and a couple months later, it's no one's gonna remember it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a very kind of comforting thing. It's public humiliation is not the end of the world. It's not the end of the world.
It only seems that way at that moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I've always been amazed, but you're never nervous. But then I'll ask you and you'll tell me, because obviously I've watched my dad be on stage hosting
I can remember being in junior high school. We didn't call it middle school then. We called it junior high school. Having to give a speech. And I remember, because this is burned in my brain, I'll never forget it. I looked down and saw my knees shaking. It's not that I felt it. I looked down and observed, like an out-of-body moment.
Yeah.
I saw that my knees were shaking back and forth. But when I got through it, that was like, oh, okay, I got through that.
Yeah.
And then I started to become very comfortable speaking. Yeah.
It was a turn.
But
he's a performer. He doesn't even know half the time. But when he's doing something live, when he's hosting, is when he's his funniest, is when he's the quickest.
Right.
And my mom and I are always amazed. We're just like, who are you?
But so you went out for roles in the school shows and things like that?
Yeah. I remember I went out for a... Or this was PS 87, so it was fifth grade. I was maybe 10 years old, and somebody missed a rehearsal for the original school opera. We had the Metropolitan Opera Guild was doing a program with our class. And so I got instantly moved from assistant stage manager to this key role, kind of for no reason other than I needed to fill the role. And it felt right. You know, I was the first couple movies I ever saw was in a revival showing of Showboat and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers.
My favorite movie.
Which one?
Seven Brides.
Really?
My favorite movie.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah,
Howard
I love
Keel
that movie.
Dreaming.
Yeah, I suppose he is. that was those were very formative. I remember as a kid even being kind of like, you know, what are you taking me to these old movies? And then seeing them on the big screen and just falling into the music of it. So, you know, and then growing up, you know, the Disney musicals and everything were just so pivotal and perfect. So I had this performer brewing for many years, but didn't really realize it.
When did you discover that you had a gift for mimicry?
That would have, you know, well, it's funny you say that. I mean, when I was a kid, in retrospect, I remember my mother, you know, I did a Ronald Reagan impression. And I was, you know, very young. And I would just go, well, Nancy. And my mom would crack up. And she was, it's really good. And so I don't know if it was really good or if it was just
what an oddly specific.
It was an oddly specific thing. But I got this encouragement with it early. And then it wasn't until... probably getting into when I made the decision that I wanted to be a sketch performer, you know, this is kind of coming out of college or a couple of years into college, and I was like, you know, I think if I try and push at this, I can get on SNL someday. You know, that was the kind of the thing. And when that happened, I started looking very technically at what is impressions. You know, how do you do that? How do you put that in your arsenal?
Now, do you find because you sing that you have an easier time with vocal placement for imitation?
I think so.
Because I find that people who sing mm-hmm. can find that because you know where it has to come from.
Definitely.
You have to figure out where you're putting it.
Exactly.
And, oh, wow, yeah.
And, you know, with Obama,
oh, God, it's just so good.
It's down about as low as you can get. That's right. You know, it's coming from the chest. And you feel where the vibration
is. Yeah.
That's a big part of it. And impressions is this weird combination of a science, but it's a very fluid science, and everybody kind of gets to impressions their own way.
Mm-hmm. What I love about your Obama impression on camera is, I was saying to my dad, I love that you guys don't rely on makeup,
right?
Because you do a little bit just so that it's not exactly you.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't need. We all know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're Jordan Peele in front of me, but right. Obama's coming out of you. I can still tell what's what.
Yeah.
But I love that you guys didn't feel the need to rely on makeup
and prosthetics. And
yes, that's what I said. Prosthetics. Yeah. Why put all that stuff on you? We know what you're doing, and it works.
There was many years of Mad TV, which was such a
which is how I know you.
Yeah, and it was such a prosthetic heavy show.
Yeah,
like, that's what they did. They kind of disguised, and you know, I always felt like SNL, where there's not really the time to do prosthetics,
right.
It's such a better effect to see somebody who, it's not about is wearing a mask, it's about they believe they are that person.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the, you know, for instance, with that Obama thing, I got all of the technical, you know, parts of the mumbo jumbo together. But then the last piece is that internal belief that you are the guy, you know? And for whatever reason, it's like all other things you can sort of toss away, but if you really can convince yourself that you're him and see him talking, it comes together.
Now, how did you become Megan? These are the important
Megan,
questions.
Please.
I'm so sorry.
Megan.
I'm so sorry. Megan.
It's Megan.
Oh, my God.
Megan, you know, that... I don't know. There, you know, I've grown up with I've grown up around women, and so to me the thing, you know, obviously Megan, you know, she's got a distinct voice. She's got, you know, it's not like everybody talks like Megan, but when I'm playing Megan, I believe I'm a woman.
Mm-hmm. You know, ever think you'd be that pretty?
I'm trying to.
You make a pretty woman.
Well, and that's the key. I think, you know, there are a lot of guys that if in a sketch you ask them to play a woman, they're going to go into this kind of imitation of a woman, but they're not going to try and feel like a woman. They're mm-hmm. not going to try and feel pretty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which, you know, I've got that in me. I've got that instinct in me somewhere. You know, I feel like there's all these different characters, and I can access that. I think part of it for me is I have a tremendous respect for women. Like I said, I was raised by women.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like it's any kind of downgrade to try
mm-hmm.
on,
right.
try that on or any, I don't, you know, but at the same time, you know, I'm the character's definitely clowning women to an extent too, so you know that's a lot of my work in sketch and impressions is this combination of it admiring something enough to sort of submit myself to them
mm-hmm.
and just hope that it doesn't sort of betray what I'm impersonating.
Yeah.
How would you describe the, I'm not going to use that word chemistry because it gets beaten to death. How would you describe the
love affair?
the incredible dynamic that you and your longtime partner, Keegan-Michael Key, have together?
Our energies are simultaneously completely different. And the thing that makes us giggle is aligned. So it's just a very special relationship. And you know, he can do things that no one else in the world can do as a performer. He's one of those guys that has this energy, both internal and external, that's just so powerful. I mean, I've only seen several people have something comparable, like, you know, the Jim Carrey, Peter Sellers, you know, these masters of the whole instrument.
Mm-hmm.
He would probably say some very nice compliments about me. So
just take that as a given.
So we have this tremendous, you know, I think we're each other's favorite comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a part of it too.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. I was so happy for him with Don't Think Twice.
Yeah.
Because people got to see more.
Yeah.
Because he's very funny.
Yeah.
But as we've learned and talked about so many times, it seems that the best comedians can also be the best dramatic actors. Because, right, like you talk about access, they access things other people don't necessarily access.
And it's not always the other way around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, know? Yeah.
Oh, no. Not at all.
But he's so good in that, and I was so happy. I feel a bit like a hipster with a bunch of records going, you know, I knew Keegan and Jordan before they were cool.
Right, right.
But because I've watched you for such a long time, and I got my dad into Key and Peele because I would see it, and I thought it was so funny, and I'd show him, and he'd laugh, and my mom would laugh. And to get each one of us with our differences and everything else to make us all laugh, that is an art form. It really is.
And part, you know, we found this all the time, that Key and Peele is a show that people discover because of a family member.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they show another family member. So there's this familial thing, and it's something that's only possible because so much of it was these YouTube clips.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, it was kind of I think it was the first sketch show to really take advantage of short form online content, and it was shareable.
Mm-hmm.
So we, you know, fans of Key and Peele, we have just a very familial relationship with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of a sudden, instead of, you know, I watched In Living Color and watched these guys doing this thing that was so far away, and they were on such a pedestal for me, and they were heroes. People watched Key and Peele in the palm of their hand.
Yeah.
Mm. It was an intimate experience.
Mm. Exactly. It's the difference between being a movie star on a 60-foot screen and being in someone's home, or as you said now, someone in their hands while they're commuting to work on the bus.
That's right.
You come into their consciousness in a different way.
In a different way. Mm-hmm. And it's not, and it's, I think, just as important.
Mm.
I think that, you know, there's something when we go to see a film and we're sitting with sitting in a crowd of strangers, you know, essentially worshiping this huge face or this huge icon that's up there. But then there's also something about the person, you know, when it feels like you're getting your own private two-man show.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And as you say, just as valuable.
Can we talk? I don't know if you're going to segue into this or if I have to, but we have to talk about Gremlins and Gremlins 2 for a second.
That's all anyone wanted us to ask you about.
Yeah. So
has told me this.
It was coming.
Oh, yeah.
I jumped the gun a little bit.
Let's go.
This is your gun to jump.
I cannot believe, I regret Leonard. And one of the biggest regrets in my career is that I did not have someone in the Gremlins 2 sketch pitch room pitch Leonard Maltin doing a review of the first Gremlins in the movie Gremlins 2, and that Star Magic didn't greenlight that in the room.
You know, next time around.
Right?
You know, next time around.
And that's, for anyone who doesn't know, there's a sketch that is hilarious, and hilarious in part because my dad is in Gremlins 2.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've listened to the podcast, you've heard us tell that story, especially the part where Joe was saying, no, just use your own words.
And so, and I don't know if you've told the story on this podcast, but, you know, the story about how exactly you ended up in that movie, but I thought it was pretty fascinating.
Yes. I'll repeat it briefly, which is that, are you asking me because you don't know?
No, I think you did tell me, but I don't know if they know. But
Well, just briefly, what it is that I had only recently, within a year or so, been hired by this red-hot TV show, a building-to-be red-hot TV show called Entertainment Tonight, and I was their movie reviewer. And so this I don't hang out with movie makers. I mean, I don't, you know, kick back with filmmakers. And once I got this job, I really wanted to avoid doing that because it's no fun to criticize somebody you know. And no one wants to be in that position.
Right.
So, but it so happens that Joe Dante and I go back a long, long way. We're both grew up in New Jersey. He got to make this, he'd made some low-budget movies for Roger Corman, and then got this big, big opportunity to make a movie called Gremlins for Steven Spielberg's company. Big, 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 big movie, which I didn't really care for that much. I found it too mean-spirited. That was my take on it. And unfortunately, there was no one else to review the movie. I couldn't pass it on to the other reviewer on the show. I was the only reviewer on the show, and it was too big a movie to be ignored. So I went on the air, and it cost me sleep several nights, but I went on the air and told it the way it was, how I saw it. And it caused a rift between me and Joe, which I completely understand, because it's like telling somebody your baby is ugly. You know, just, you know. And also, he'd put so many in-jokes in that movie for his film buff pals, which I appreciated, of course. So a couple of years go by, and I get a call from his producing partner saying that they're going to make Gremlins 2, and there's going to be this scene where the Gremlins invade this TV network and ruin all these shows. And one of them, they wanted to be a movie review show. And would I be willing to be the movie reviewer? And I said to Mike Fennell, I think I owe you that much. So I found myself on a soundstage at Warner Brothers in a set, holding up a VHS cassette of Gremlins. And Joe Dante, the director of Gremlins, says to me, don't worry about the script. Just use your own words. So he directs me to give a bad review to his first movie in his sequel. And that's exactly how that came about. It also got me on three Topps story of the movie cards.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I used to call them gum cards, but they stopped putting gum in the packets. But yes, that's my immortality, is being on those cards.
Mm-hmm.
The movie's great too, but the cards. Anyhow, that's how that all came about. And
so you mean your pitch is that Leonard Maltin, film reviewer extraordinaire of Entertainment Tonight, who somehow is, for some reason, taping a show at Clamp Tower where all the mayhem of the Gremlins is happening simultaneously around him, is given a review of the first movie in the second movie, something not previously done or done since in any movie. It's in the movie.
It's in the movie.
It's in the movie.
It's in the movie.
It was, you know, and that this era you're talking about, by the way, that's like Gremlins 2 is like Ben-Hur for me. Like, let's be real. And Gremlins 1, I still will go to the mat on Gremlins 1. I don't know if you still maintain that it was too mean, but
I haven't revisited it. I have to be honest with you.
It's a masterpiece.
Well, and I have no reason to doubt you.
And I did have the cards as well. I did have the cards. I'm sorry.
Wow.
I'll never forget the first time someone showed it to me.
Yeah.
Someone showed me the clip. Because I was four when you did that, something like that. Right, and somebody went, have you ever seen your dad get killed by gremlins? I said, what are you talking about?
Well, anyway, I'm honored that you respected the movie enough to do that very funny sketch. And the fact that you're talking about it today makes up for any omission you may have made. So,
okay, good. I'm glad.
I don't know how I'm supposed to.
He'll take the effigy down.
Yeah.
Okay,
right,
good,
yeah.
Good.
He'll remove the pins when we get home.
Really?
Yeah, we're playing on an even field now. everything's good.
He says that, but he's crafty. Watch him like a hawk.
Believe it.
But thank you. Thank you for the sentiment.
You're welcome.
Very, very kind and very thoughtful of you. You guys covered so much ground on that show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So much territory. And what I love about it is that just like any other smart show, like The Simpsons, I mean, there's so many smart, funny shows that don't talk down to their audience,
mm-hmm.
that don't worry about whether the audience will get every reference,
mm-hmm.
or maybe even get every reference right away.
Mm-hmm.
When I was growing up, I grew into those references, watching old cartoons.
Right.
Didn't get them when I was 8 years old, but maybe I got them when I was 12 or 15 or 25.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's what that meant.
Well, when I saw Spaceballs when I was a kid, you love these movies. When I saw Spaceballs, it was, you know, besides Gremlins 2, it was like the best thing I'd ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
Now, recently I've gone back and go, I couldn't have possibly understood half of these references.
Oh, yeah.
So you get something because of the confidence that it's done with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That, I mean, no one was using the term meta when Mel Brooks made Spaceballs.
Right.
But popping that cassette in to watch what's happened in the movie so far.
Right.
Is maybe the first truly meta moment.
That's a great call.
In movies.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Incredible.
Groundbreaking stuff.
Incredible.
I wish there was more, you know, of that today.
Yeah.
Well, but you brought a lot. I mean, really, you've contributed quite a bit, and you're just getting started. It's not like we're at the end here. There's a lot to come.
And yeah. you did a lot of cinematic stuff on your show.
Yeah,
I mean, you got pretty elaborate.
Yeah,
you know we had Peter Atencio is the mm-hmm. director of Key and Peele. He shot 97% of the sketches, and I think he's the best director that's ever done sketch. And one of the best directors out there, period. He's so cinematic, and he's such a lover of film. And, you know, for everybody working on that show, this was like, you know, it was like having a television show that was a genie lamp.
Mm.
It was a holodeck. Wherever we wanted to go, we could make that happen. Whatever we wanted to deal with, we could make that happen. So I think the big reason that show works for the people it works for is because they can feel how much fun we're having.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I'm sitting here laughing because I'm going through them in my head. I'm going through all the different things in my head, and that's the greatest gift you could give me is I think about it and I'm laughing.
That is awesome.
That's great. It's a great thing. I'm picturing the Walking Dead thing. That's what I kept
the
all this
racist
morning.
Zombies one or oh no, the Walking Dead.
That one. And it's been all morning today, that's all I've been hearing in my head is she going, oh, baby.
I don't know if you've seen this sketch line, but it's basically on the set of Walking Dead, and Keegan and I are playing zombie background performers.
Obviously.
And when it comes to the point where we have to go, or something, you know, my character, we've never done this before, my character just goes, you know, this little squeak kind of comes out, and he goes, "Hey,
it's really funny. Go watch it. It's really good.
If you can find it, I don't know if that one's.
It's all there.
It's all
on the internet. The internet finds everything.
You can run, but you can't hide.
Honestly, yeah.
not these days.
No.
So, right. And then we were at South by Southwest when Keanu premiered.
You were,
and people went nuts for it.
Oh, cool! Thank
they
you.
They went nuts for it. And when you see that movie, South By is its audience because they are there to have a good time.
Yeah. And that's a fun movie.
It's fun.
And again, you work with your director, Peter Atencio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who just, he murdered that movie in the best of ways.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing quite like it.
Well, how do you pitch it to someone?
Yeah,
There's this kitten. You see, there's this kitten.
That was one that, you know, Alex Rubens and I, who Alex is, you know, one of the Key and Peele writers and a very good friend, a year and a half or 2 years earlier, we saw the writing on the wall and said, you know, I think there's going to be a need for a Key and Peele movie at some point. So we got kind of started early. We had a script. We're like, what if we just had a script when they come knocking? And that's kind of how it happened. You know, we got to that point where, you know, thankfully New Line said, "What, you know, do you guys have anything?" And
oh, conveniently enough.
Yeah.
You mean this?
You mean this old thing?
This that lives in my car
24/7? That's just a ready-to-go script.
Now, did you find it, not to inject too serious a note here, but did you find it challenging to take the same muscles you were using to write short form sketches and have to sustain a feature length film.
Very challenging. Very challenging. I mean, it's, you know, so you sort of, I went into the process thinking, well, I can write a sketch. That means I can write a scene. And I can write 20 sketches, so that means I can write 20 scenes in a row. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this, there is a type of, there is structure to film. And even movies that often seem like they're not, that they're structureless, tend to still be obeying some structure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they're super obscure and you're not hearing about them. But they're, you know, it's all, you know, film structure is very linked to, Jungian theory and Joseph Campbell, you know, archetypal theory. Mm-hmm. There is a certain way that human beings digest story. And there's a certain way that it seems to fall, that story structure seems to fall, that is most compelling to people. And it has something to do with this sort of, this existential, you know, concept of self and our own personal journeys as seen through the protagonist. It's really fascinating.
Did you, other than casting yourselves, which was an obvious choice, did you write any of the supporting roles with the specific actors in mind?
No. Mm-hmm. We wrote that long before we knew it was going to get made.
Uh-huh.
And, there might have been a couple that we had, you know, a sort of film trope archetypes in mind. Mm-hmm. But the cast we settled on was fresh ideas for us and people that came in.
So, I mean, you didn't write in the script the Luis Guzman character.
You're right.
Because it seems like
no.
That's what he's playing is the Luis Guzman character.
He's playing Luis Guzman. Thank you. He does Luis Guzman characters better than anyone.
Right?
He's the best at it.
He's the best at it, absolutely.
Hey, buddy, hey, my friend. I love you, brother. I love you, man. He is the sweetest man and really, really a pretty brilliant actor. I mean, he's been in so many truly amazing films.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great career.
Great career. Time. And so just the kind of guy, when you're around him, you just soak up everything he has to say. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's neat. I don't know where to, there's so
I
much.
Know, I
there's
know,
so
I
much.
Know. He has so many questions about your inspirations, the people,
okay.
Because he got to ask you about Flanagan and Allen.
Yes.
And
which I'm sure happens every day.
Everyone wants to know about Flanagan and Allen.
Yes.
Childish Gambino, Flanagan and Allen.
Right.
It's one of the two.
Yeah.
How did I get their the song?
They're on there. The next Jay-Z album, I think.
Yeah. Flanagan and Allen. Yeah.
All right. Not to be too inzy here or arcane about this, but in the opening setup scene of Mr. Peele's movie Get Out, the one that you ought to see if you haven't. In fact, if you haven't seen Get Out, I'm going to dare to say this. If you still haven't seen it, don't listen to the rest of this podcast. Watch it and then come back and listen to the rest of this podcast, because I saw it knowing nothing about it, and I'm convinced that that is the best way to see this movie.
Yeah.
And
folks have heard us say it, but what happened was, and this is the delight of a movie theater. These are the good things. My husband and I had seen a trailer for Get Out, and we said, this looks good, plus we're fans of yours. We said, this looks good. Let's go see it. I was home, and this is rare that my parents are not at a movie in the evening. That's normally where they go. And I said to my parents, why don't you just come with us? Come see this movie. And, of course, we didn't know what it was, but my dad, having become a fan, said, yeah, I'll give it a shot, sure. So we went to the Arclight, and we sat down and saw this movie. And it has become, I know he's told you, it's his favorite film of the year. It's right up there for me.
Thank you.
And that is why it's important for everyone. It's so hard this time of year, if you're in LA, but also if you're anywhere industry, because I don't want to read every single story. I don't want to know every single shot. I don't want to know any of that. I want to walk in and be impressed by the film. And that's how people should see it.
Yes.
And
But one of the biggest crimes about the making a movie, especially one like Get Out, is that I never get to experience the first time.
Yeah.
It's always it starts with the second time. You know, I never get to feel what an audience feels like with some of those reveals, and I can only kind of imagine it. If I had one of those Men in Black sort of memory erasers, I would love to watch the movie, but
we'll find some Amish people.
I'm glad you did.
Because there we know.
And then what, sit by them and watch them watch it?
Yeah.
Absorb their
vibe. We'll act it out with puppets. Act it out with puppets. It'll be fine. It'll work.
I wonder how the Amish would feel about Get Out. We might really resonate.
Huge Amish hit. I'm calling it now.
We know they, you know, after all they yell at the screen, you know, they're, you know, go, you know.
You're going to hell.
Stop backing up. Stop backing up into the darkness. What are you, an idiot? I don't know what.
I was thinking about the fact that how we're talking about timing, and timing, of course, is everything in life as it is in comedy. How fortunate that you and your partner came of age when a certain man was in the White House instead of, say, George W. Bush. You just lucked out there. You got to admit, sometimes things happen the way they're supposed to happen.
Didn't know that Keegan got to do the
Correspondence
Dinner with Barack.
Seen that.
He hasn't.
So, yeah, Luther, the anger translator, that was one of these most surreal...
I can't imagine.
Meta moments.
Yeah.
And the way we looked at it is Luther, you know, the anger translator of President Obama, in that moment, he became the anger translator for President Obama.
Yep.
Just so unbelievable.
The character transcended being a character and in at least a joking way, served a purpose. But to your point, I mean, yeah, you know, we had... Who knows what career trajectory, what paths our career would have taken if Obama had not been elected. But I do know that a big part of us being able to be relevant at the time when Comedy Central took our show on was that we shared a racial identity with the president. We had a point of view in terms of code switching and other things that aren't really talked about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea of being mixed or biracial is kind of rarely talked about, although it's a very common thing. And so that was, you know, the black president who was also a mixed president and somebody who navigates both spaces was the centerpiece of a national conversation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we all of a sudden we had a place.
Yeah. And what a place! What a place you carved for yourself.
Yeah. Thank you.
And continue to carve for yourself. All right. So as I've warned you, now we're going to talk about Get Out.
Okay. I'm
Leonard Maltin will come to your door and
I'm
turn
ready
this off.
This is...
No, but come to your door.
It's such a good film, but. It's also such a rich film. You've put so much in it. And I read one interview where you talked about, I think it was in the Writers Guild magazine, which was a very good conversation, about not wanting to give white people in the audience a pass, a way to sort of get off the hook. Mm-hmm. And that there were crucial moments in your development of the story where you could have, or you might have, but you didn't.
Yeah, and you know, it actually came less from the motivation of trolling white people, and more from the motivation of there is this expected notion in movies that you have to have a white savior, you have to have a good white person, even in a slavery movie. You know, there has to be somebody, you know, Brad Pitt has to come in with like, you know, flowing, slow motion, long hair and sort of tell the audience, wink, I'm you, don't worry about it. So because we know that has to happen, I knew no one would suspect that reveal. So I'm essentially using I was just talking about this earlier today, but, you know, the way Hitchcock uses in Psycho, and in many of his films, he uses the thing. He uses the history of film to his advantage, the history of storytelling. There's no way this protagonist is going to get killed halfway through the movie. That's the same thing with the Rose reveal. There's no way, even if you think it's possible, you instantly would go, nah, but a movie can't do that. I think the reason white people still like the movie, even though they do not have a white savior, is because I'm not talking down to white people either. I'm assuming that you're identifying with Chris, the protagonist.
Yeah.
I'm not assuming you're identifying with the white people in this film, which is, I think, you know, it goes to this thing you're saying of people like it when you treat them as being smart, intellectually and emotionally mm-hmm. smart as well. And I think people feel that. I respect the audience.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it shows, and it has paid off.
Yeah.
It has paid off for you. Absolutely. And, of course, everybody must be asking you the same question, and I hope it's not one that you've answered to death, mm-hmm. but do you have more ideas percolating in your head?
I do. I do. And right now I'm working on a script right now for the next movie I'm going to write, and I can't really say anything about it, but I can say I want more Hitchcockian tales. I want more Brian De Palma. I mm-hmm. want more Kubrick. I want more Spielberg. So I'm pushing in the direction, continuing in the direction of genre.
Uh huh.
And specifically, I love B movie premises that are executed in as elevated a way as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what Jaws is to me. That's what the best movies of all time are. That Alien,
mm-hmm.
Things that you could read in a pulp magazine, but taken with that's Hitchcock, right? And done with finesse and as much artistry as possible.
Yeah.
Now, clearly, you didn't see because I looked this morning, and the whole the jig is up because IMDb has this.
Okay.
Untitled Jordan Peele project, 2019.
Well, you want to hear meta?
Thriller, in development, plot unknown, described as a quote unquote social thriller.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they've got you, man.
They've got it. Well, that's the meta part. There is that the title is actually Untitled Jordan Peele project.
I really wanted to hear that so much. I love seeing that. IMDb is always full of gifts, but that was like, yes, this movie that may or may not exist. Boy, mm-hmm, yeah. Watch out, world.
You know, I can always put that out there, by the way. There's always an untitled Jordan Peele project in the works.
You should submit like 7.
And just see
and
which
just
one.
See how many go through yeah, and if we can have you in production for 40 different films. And
Now, would you ever consider directing yourself?
I would, you know, more than I've ever been comfortable imagining now. I think at some point it could be an interesting mm-hmm. Addition to the project of directing, but also kind of no. I'm just not. I don't currently have the acting bug.
Hmm.
I love directing so much. It's just better.
It must be a very heady experience. What's the best piece of advice you got about your first directorial effort?
That someone gave me?
Both ways. What that somebody gave you?
Well, before I did this movie, I remember meeting Ben Affleck mm-hmm. at the Pacquiao Mayweather fight. I didn't talk to him for very long, but I did tell him I'm working on this movie and you've had some success with directing. And I asked him, I was telling him, look, I'm scared. I'm scared I'm going to miss something. I'm scared there's that thing that I don't know because I haven't done it. And then when I look at the dailies the first day, I'm going to see, oh my God, I'm making one of those movies. An ugly movie or something like that. And he told me, you know, the fear is good. The fear is your greatest weapon against, you know, it's what will keep you on the ball. If you didn't have fear, you should, then that's time to worry. And that was a very comforting sort of like hack for that emotion. It's like, yeah, fear, let's use the fear. Let's see, why am I afraid, and let's address that. And so that was great advice. The advice I have for others is be take improv class. I think the ability to respect the obstacles as gifts is priceless. You know, that's the only way I was able to make this movie for $4.5 million is every obstacle that came along, I treated it like it was, you know, the best thing that happened to the movie. And, you know, strive to figure out why it was the best thing that happened to the movie.
Interesting. You know that Orson Welles quote about director being someone who presides over happy accidents?
Yes.
Did you have happy accidents?
That is a really great way of saying what I'm trying to say here. It's all happy accidents, except for the certain things that you need to tell your story. And I think that's probably where the director's skill and knowledge of what they're doing is most important. There's two categories. There are the things that just can't change. And those have to be kept because you have to be able to tell the story you're telling. And everything else kind of can be changed. And that's what improv helped me do, figure out, is how much exactly can change. Because I think there's a lot of people that think none of it can change. No, it's got to be a red shirt. It's got to be a red shirt or else we can't go on. And, you know, with improv, you go, no, not only is it not a red shirt anymore, but it's a green shirt, and that's awesome because green, it's the color of envy, and it's the... So being malleable is just as important as being firm.
Well, what a wonderful thing to realize so early in your directorial career. I mean, there are a lot of people who didn't get that first time out, and haven't still gotten that the 10th time out.
Nothing gets you there better than improv, I think, except maybe, you know, Bruce Lee style, you know, Jeet Kune Do or whatever. But it is. It's this feeling of like, you got to be like water, you know? Some, you know, firm as ice, but then also fluid as gas?
Yep, that's
I believe that's what he said. I mean, he said it in, you know, Chinese.
Someone on Sunset is getting it tattooed right now. Right now it's happening. What was the hardest part of directing? I mean, because obviously, I think like you set yourself up to a certain degree, you have an idea. And you did Keanu, so you had one film under your belt in that way, where you're in all the sort of corners, you're doing so much.
Yes.
But I can't imagine you're good at pretend. And I don't know how much for yourself you had to pretend that you were ready to then and tell everyone. Because people look to the director, you're the captain. And so you have to show everyone, I'm not scared. That's silly. Of course I'm not scared.
That's right.
While we all know everybody has to be scared.
You really do have to project a confidence. You have to be calm. This idea of projecting the correct type of leadership, and you know, it's different for everybody. But your best leader self is a huge part of it. With actors, you know, we had 23 days. So with actors,
hold on.
So fast.
23 days.
It's so fast.
Holy moly.
So I had to know exactly what I was doing every second of the day. And then I had to be ready to change that up on the fly. and it gives you no time. And actors, I'm really dedicated to actors because I know how that feels. And actors need their process. You know, I tried to give every actor their chosen process. It's the best I could manage that. And so for me, a lot of time, sometimes an actor needs to stop and talk about something. And it's very important for me that even if we had no time and we didn't have time for that, mm-hmm. for me to project the illusion to the actor that we've got all day for this. Hmm. And there's a truth to it. It's like, look, nothing else matters if we don't get it right.
Absolutely.
For the performance.
Yeah.
So in a sense, you know, let's figure this out. I'm going to give you my attention.
Mm. And I'm sure they appreciate it. And having seen you with some of your actors, you guys seem to have a really lovely relationship.
Yeah. I mean, with a movie like this, too, it's where nobody's making a lot of money.
Right.
And it's a movie that, you know, it could fail so many ways. If the tone isn't right,
mm-hmm.
then the movie is a real disaster.
No, the tone is everything in this movie.
Everything. And you could, to an extent, you could sense that it was going somewhere on the page, but you still couldn't necessarily trust or envision what I was seeing as far as the tone, or even if I could describe it as like Stepford Wives meets Scream or
sure.
something,
mm-hmm. sure,
you couldn't trust that I could pull that off in my first time, so. Our relationship is built on this immense trust. Me putting my baby in their hands and them putting their babies in my hands, their whole careers, really.
Yeah. Well, they came through for you, that's for sure.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Every single one. Well, I don't know what there's left to say except that congratulations are due to you for a job well done, better than well done.
Yeah, right.
Just, you know, just before we started, you know, we were talking about movies, and you asked me if, as a critic, I see more good movies than not good movies. And the answer is no. I wish I saw more good movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that all the good movies I saw were successful, because that's really frustrating when you see something that has turned out well and it doesn't find its audience.
Yeah.
That's so frustrating.
Yeah.
And it's the best part of my job, and I think all my colleagues would say the same, when we get to champion a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe persuade some people to go to see it. So when you see a good movie and the word does get out and people do go to see it and then they remember it when it comes time to vote for awards, is like a minor miracle.
Yeah. So I don't think it's a minor miracle in this town. This is it's a damn miracle.
Anyway, congratulations.
Thank
Sincerest
you.
Yeah. congratulations
Thank
on,
you.
On doing such a wonderful job with a movie that is one of a kind.
Thank you.
And we love it.
And come back with your next movie.
And come back with your next
movie. I'm in.
This is super fun. Possible thriller, Untitled Jordan Peele
Project. Untitled Jordan Peele Project.
I cannot wait.
I will not wait for Untitled Jordan Peele Project Part 2 to come and see you guys.
All right. That suits us fine. Thank you. Are you a social media person?
I'm on Twitter. I'm Jordan Peele on Twitter. And I'm Jordan Peele on Instagram. So I haven't.
You are at Leonard Maltin. I am at Jesse Maltin on the Twitter and the Instagram. And you can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book reviews and all the stuff that's fit to print.
That's a good slogan.
Thanks.
I'll think about
that.
Okay.
Thank
you. And thank you, Jordan, for being here.
Yeah.
And
happy birthday.
And oh, yes.
Happy
birthday.
Thank you for spending an hour with us on your birthday.
This is my present to myself.
All right. God bless. Thank you so much.
You
take care, folks. See you next time.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.